103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. If you want to get in touch with the programme, email mentalwealth@dublincityfm.ie. On today's programme, it's taken a while to get this man into a recording and onto the programme, but I'm talking with Paul Murphy, TD. Paul has been on the news quite a bit in the last few years and a central figure in his political activities out in Dublin Southwest. It is Dublin Southwest, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. You were first on the political scene in Ireland probably when you became an MEP.
Yeah, I took over from Joe Higgins. Joe was elected in 2009 in what was seen then as quite a shock upset when we won one of three seats in Dublin. Joe then returned to the Dáil in early 2011, and I was on the substitute list and took over as an MEP and continued until the European elections in 2014, where we stood for re-election. We did reasonably well, but we didn't get re-elected.
Now, of course, you didn't just fill in an advertisement that you saw, you know, do you want to be an MEP? Joe Higgins is coming back to the Dáil. You'd been around quite a while. You would have been involved in the Shell to Sea stuff that was going on in Rossport.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a political activist since I was a teenager and was a member, an active member of the Socialist Party for that time as well. So I suppose some of the stuff that I was involved in was the fees campaign against the attempted reintroduction of full fees for a third level education back in kind of 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6. They kind of kept coming back. Obviously, the movement against the war in Iraq was a defining political moment for me. And then definitely the Rossport campaign, the Shell to Sea campaign, which is funny because in hindsight it has some similarities to the water charges in the sense of some of the behaviour of the police at certain protests, but the fact that they were able to get away with it in a small isolated rural community, and that small isolated rural community was ultimately beaten by the might of Shell, backed up by the state, and they weren't able to get away with it, thankfully, in the water charges, because it was happening in urbanised areas, it was happening with the existence of social media, with camera phones. It was just such a different world.
So you are in Europe and you're an MEP. Was that a shock to the system? Like, it's a big jump from working on small campaigns over here, and next year you're up there against Barroso and these kind of guys in the European Parliament.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I had the advantage that from 2009 to 2011, when I took over, I was working with Joe in Brussels. I moved to Brussels and was Joe's assistant, along with others as part of a good team. So I had an idea and was able to learn from Joe in terms of the kind of approach to take. But definitely, I remember going into the Parliament, like the plenary session of the Parliament, for the first couple of times and speaking. And you know, it's a huge parliament. I mean, the Irish Parliament is tiny. If people come and actually see it, it's very, very small. Whereas the European Parliament now has 751 members. It was slightly more at that stage. It's immense. And exactly, you're speaking against some of the political representatives of European capitalism, challenging them. Initially, that's a challenging thing. But then I suppose, like a lot of things, you know, it's amazing what humans can get used to, and you adapt to it, that this is now your role in the struggle, as opposed to the other things that I was doing previously. Now I have the privilege of being a voice for people in Ireland, but also across Europe, on austerity, on the complete lack of democracy within Europe, but also on kind of human rights issues right across the world.
And do you find that you're very adaptive to stress and those kind of pressures of work?
I suppose initially I found myself subject to stress and feeling the stress of being in a public position. That can be a stressful thing in and of itself. I remember being stressed about doing media interviews, radio interviews, TV interviews, whatever. And I think the stress comes from the fact that you want to do a good job, and then if you don't do a good job, well, that's going to be there for everybody to see. And especially today, that can go viral. And, you know, even a relatively small interview can turn into a big deal. So it probably took maybe a year and a half to kind of fully get used to that, to do enough of it that then you become comfortable with it, more relaxed about it, which also means you're more likely to perform well about it, and therefore it's kind of a positive reinforcement.
One of the bodies of work that you did out in Europe was with disabilities, and you would have been one of the first people pushing the Irish government on the UN CRPD, which was ratified the 27th out of 27 countries last week by the Irish government and Minister McGrath. What was it like back in those early days, campaigning and pushing that one up the hill?
Yeah, I mean, I was really fortunate that one of the people who was part of my team, Tanya, who's a German who works in Belgium, worked with our team in the European Parliament, formerly worked with people with disabilities and therefore had a real understanding of the area and knew a lot of the key people. So we worked closely with the Centre for Independent Living and with kind of EU advocates who were pushing. They do a thing called the Freedom Drive every year where people go to Strasbourg, which is where the European Parliament sits, and kind of put it up to the politicians. So I was able to play a role in helping to like facilitate that. I was able to speak at a really good conference. We did a lot of people from across Europe speaking about their experiences, and you could see that, I mean, to be honest, the struggle around disability issues is more advanced in other European countries. It's very focused on the notion of independent living, of not being institutionalized, etc. Whereas to some extent here, things are more basic as a result of just the complete lack of resources that are given. Just the basic resources to allow people to even think about independent living aren't really given here, or certainly aren't given easily here by the government. And a definite illustration of that is the fact that Ireland was the only EU country not to ratify up till last week the UN CRPD, which is shocking. And one of the most shocking things about it was when questioned in the Dáil and elsewhere about why don't you ratify it, they'd say, oh, we'd love to ratify it, but first of all, we'd like to actually provide the rights, we'd like to have the resources to be able to give the rights. But that's exactly the point, you know, is that we want the ratification, we want to sign up, and we want the resources to make the rights real. And ultimately what happened, I think they were right on the verge of the 11th anniversary of signing it without ratification. And I think the embarrassment got too much, and so therefore they have finally ratified it, so that's good. But they still haven't put in place the resources to make the rights that are outlined in the convention real. And now the battle is to use the fact that, okay, now you've ratified this, now you actually have a legal obligation to provide these rights, so where are they?
And they did that last week without fanfare, because it must have been quite embarrassing to have been so late. What now? People can take the Irish government to the United Nations kind of and hold them up against you know, what they said they would do. They're kind of exposed now on a 6-monthly basis. They can be challenged.
Yeah, I think it's via the Human Rights Commission that this can be raised, but it gives a weapon on every single issue for disability rights activists. When you look at, I mean, the waiting lists for kids in particular to get access to services that they need are just chronic. Like, they're just incredible. I'm dealing with so many people who are on waiting lists for years. And it's not that the ratification by itself makes that go away, but it is definitely an argument in their hands, in our hands, to say to the government, look, you have to deliver on this, and also to shame them on the international stage. Because, I mean, for example, on that issue, all of the evidence, of course, is early intervention makes a huge difference later on. And the government officially subscribes to that. It talks about that, but it doesn't do anything about it. So even on some sort of like, you know, narrow-minded economic measure, it makes more sense to invest the money, intervene early, rather than dealing with all the consequences that come from not doing that.
So here's a tough question for you. Is it easier to work on behalf of those people on a local level or from out there in the European level? Are they just two different things?
I think it's probably possible to be more effective here in the Dáil. Not because mostly our votes are decisive in the Dáil and we can force the government to do things just by our votes alone, but because you're closer to people. People pay a lot more attention to what happens in the Dáil for very understandable reasons, and it means that the Dáil is a more effective platform to get your ideas across, to assist with people mobilizing, to give assistance to movements. And that's, like, ultimately that's how we saw the European Parliament and see the Dáil, is that primarily it's a platform, it's a way to amplify the voices of those who are struggling, and with us giving assistance to that, but also potentially, like on water charges, using it to put forward particular tactics like non-payment to popularise those. And it did prove very effective there. So yeah, I think the Dáil on balance, and also because, I mean, it is a positive for movements that the government is weak. The fact that the government does not have a majority, that it relies on Fianna Fáil, is good. Not because Fianna Fáil are any better than Fine Gael, but because they're nominally in opposition, they can be put under pressure, and then, you know, the kind of dominoes fall one by one. The left takes a position, then Sinn Féin takes the position, then Fianna Fáil takes the position, and then the government doesn't want to be beaten in a vote, and it may abstain or not vote or whatever. So victories can be won on things as a consequence of the weak nature of the government.
So you make that transition from Europe to working in the Dáil because you defended your MEP seat in summer of 2014, unsuccessful in that situation, but then roll forward to October the 11th, a day we won't forget, 2014. Most people were out marching against, it was a lovely sunny day by the way, against the water charges, but you were somewhere else because you were fighting a by-election for the chap from Fine Gael who, Hayes was it, got into the parliament, and you were battling for that by-election, and the result was?
Yeah, well, we won the by-election, I mean, really against all predictions, to be honest, against our own internal predictions before we started the campaign. It seemed that it was an open and shut case for Sinn Féin to win the election, but we won the election because of a firm, absolutely clear opposition to water charges, married with a strategy that could defeat water charges, that wasn't based on saying, you vote for us, we'll get rid of it for you. Instead, was saying, vote for us, we'll be a voice for this campaign, we'll advocate non-payment, and then you need to refuse to pay, you can refuse to pay, join the protest movement, and we'll be able to defeat the government. And it obviously was, you know, very fortunate that the 11th of October saw two big blows to water charges on the one day. And from that moment on, the water charges policy of the government began to shake. They announced within a month a significant enough rollback. They delayed the charges by 3 months. They reduced the charges, and they began to talk about reasonable people would now see that all the issues are resolved.
And they added the grant as well.
Yeah, exactly. They came up with
the bribe.
They came up with this €100 conservation grant, which had nothing to do with conservation. It was just designed to get people to sign up to the Irish Water Utility.
So you're in the Dáil about a wet month, and then the Jobstown thing happens, which has taken up the last 3.5-4 years of your life. Well, three and a half. Among the other work that you continue to do. But just to put that in context, just the week before October the 11th was the issue where the Jones phones, and she was talking about people shouldn't have, you know, or they do have terribly nice phones to be videoing these. An installation of water meters was really what was happening down on the ground in a big way, and there was a lot of opposition, a huge amount of opposition to that. And then there's a protest that you don't organise happening in Jobstown, and you go along to it because it's in the topic and area that you're most interested in. And if anyone doesn't know about it, briefly tell us what happens that day.
Yeah, I mean, the other context is, so 11th of October, you have this massive demonstration, 100,000 people, and then on the first weekend of November, you have regional protests. I think over 100 protests across the country, including big protests, thousands of people in Tala, in Walkinstown.
That's the rainy day one, yeah.
Yeah, and it's part of this like further escalation of the movement. The government is really worried about where this is pointing, combined with the by-election results. So yeah, John Burton arrives, is in Jobstown to be at a ceremony for on Kusan, giving out a graduation ceremony, so giving out certificates for people. There's a protest. I'm not there at the time. That there's two locations involved, on Kusan and then the church around the corner. She walks from on Kusan to the church. There's a protest around her, at which, unfortunately and wrongly, she's hit with a water balloon. Then she gets into the church. The crowd gathers. It gets bigger and bigger. She leaves the church. She gets into a car. At this stage, I am present. There's a sit-down protest behind that car for maybe half an hour. She's then moved into another Jeep. There's a sit-down protest in front of that Garda Jeep for a short amount of time, maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And then there's a slow march from there until kind of the exit of Jobstown, the Jobstown Inn, where she's transferred to another car and she drives away.
Peaceful protest, but distasteful at times, the video evidence would show.
I was talking about this with someone else, another journalist, the other day, and I made the point that the defence insisted that we showed all the video evidence, that the whole event was shown from all the different angles over the course of 3 hours in order to avoid the prosecution showing like a low-light version, you know? Because there were things that happened at the protest that I'm against, you know, I didn't organise, I'm completely opposed to, like the water balloon, like there is, you know, the sporadic use of misogynistic insults and so on. But there was definitely an attempt by the prosecution, but also by large sections of the media, to say that that was the essence of what the protest was, very ugly scenes. And it just wasn't. And that's, you know, the jury got to see the whole 3 hours, and the thing had the character of a protest, predominantly women involved in the protest, you know, ordinary people from a community rising to a size of maybe 500 people, expressing the anger of people about water charges, but also all of the cuts, lone parents cuts, child benefit cuts, cuts to local community services that had been carried out, people chanting, people marching, people carrying banners, and people sitting down peacefully. So stuff happened. For example, after Joan Burton was gone, that was nothing to do with the protest, and nobody, say, who was along on the trial with me was charged with anything in relation to that, or the likes of the water balloon. But then we were arrested in February of 2015, and I was charged with false imprisonment, and the first trial was six people who were just charged with false imprisonment. Others were then charged with false imprisonment and violent disorder, and then others without false imprisonment and some other charges like violent disorder. But the case against us, you know, was not that we were involved in misogynistic abuse or bad language or, you know, anything like that. The case against us was that we falsely imprisoned, i.e. kidnapped Joan Burton because we sat down in front of her car. That was the prosecution's case, and because we marched slowly in front of the car. They weren't saying that I or anyone else on trial alongside me was involved in anything else. So what this ultimately came down to was about the right of people to protest. Do people have the right to protest and to impede the progress of a minister, of a tánaiste, or does that amount to kidnapping and you could be sent to jail for a long time for it?
I was going to ask you about the arrests. There was a week where there was rolling arrests every morning. There were dawn arrests and there was many Gardaí in attendance, but they could have just rung you up and asked you to, you know, come in for interview or come in under caution or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost 2 weeks that there were, you know, huge numbers of Gardaí driving mostly around Tala, mostly around West Tala, arriving up at people's doors and arresting people in quite a heavy-handed fashion. I mean, one of my co-defendants, Scott Masterson, was handcuffed in front of his children. I had six Gardaí at my house. I think Jay Lester, who was the 16-year-old who was arrested, convicted, and then had his conviction overturned, was arrested by 8 or 10 Gardaí. It was extremely heavy-handed. And I think it was had a purpose, which was to send a message to us that we were criminals and to send a message to the public that we were criminals. They obviously could have arrested us by arrangement. If you look at how the bankers were arrested, they weren't arrested in the kind of fashion that we were arrested.
Does that kind of series of arrests put fear into a community? And like our community, what's the feeling out in Jobstown and in Dublin Southwest at the time?
You have to bear in mind that there were hundreds of people at this protest, and perhaps more were at the protest for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, went to have a look and left. And so like a large portion of the community was at the protest. I was engaged in the same sort of stuff, i.e. slow marching, sitting down, that those of us who were arrested were engaged in. So there was a real fear amongst loads of people that they were going to be next. There was really, they did strike fear into Jobstown, that your kid could be next, you could be next, you could be arrested on the way to work. I mean, I know of loads of people, including some of them who then were arrested, wondering, were they going to be arrested? I know of other people who, you know, were sitting alongside us, were walking alongside us, who thought they were going to be arrested and then never were arrested. But it was a fearful thing for the entire community. Yeah.
Having then gone through a huge trial for the first six people that you were involved in, and then you're found not guilty of this tremendous charge, and we won't go into the whole detail of the trial, does it kind of go back to that moment where the what you were charged with was just kind of a huge kind of charge that never fitted what happened on the day?
I mean,
this is hypothetical, mm-hmm. Could they have kind of progressed with lesser charges?
I mean, they could have, and it would have been more normal to progress with public order charges. I think if we had gotten a jury, which would have depended on how they prosecuted the same defence that we used, which was we were engaged in our constitutional right to protest. People have a right to protest, and the police have to facilitate that right as well as to facilitate the progress of ministers and whoever else. I think that defence would have worked there as well. I think the only way they potentially could have had convictions if they were to try us on like summary offences, i.e. offences that we wouldn't be in the circuit court where we were in and where we had access to a jury, but if we simply had a judge. I mean, that's what happened to the young guy, Jay Lester, who was 16 at the time. He was convicted on the same evidence that we were not convicted on by a judge who effectively just believed what the guards said. And I mean, that same evidence really fell apart in front of a jury under cross-examination in the circuit court, so much so that then when he appealed, which is extremely unusual, I mean, the prosecution has a conviction, they have it in the bag, he appeals it, and they don't contest the appeal, which indicates there's something quite unsound about the conviction in the first place. So I think that's the only way they could have gotten convictions, is either to get extremely lucky and get a jury which is extremely biased against us, against the left, against working class people, against those against water charges, or to not have a jury and just have a judge who goes along with what the guards say.
Paul Murphy TD came out very quickly out of the traps when these arrests were happening and said this is political policing, and I'll take a guess that this hasn't injured you too much, but I'm going to ask, has Jobstown as an area been injured? Because we saw there recently in the snow that some politicians decided this was game to have a pop at the people of Jobstown on the back of what's happened in the past and what happened during the snow. Is Jobstown hurting?
Jobstown is hurting from what happened around the Lidl. It's hurting from that because it feels that, you know, the actions of a very small minority, some of whom from Jobstown, many of whom obviously not from Jobstown, the Lidl actually not in Jobstown, but popularly in the media referred to Jobstown, has been used to and has to some extent tarnished the image of Jobstown again. I think that for the establishment in this country, which includes sections of the media establishment, the political establishment, they're not going to quickly get over the defeat they suffered on the water charges. And for some of them anyway, Jobstown, both the events itself and like a community expressing its power and delaying the Taoiseach for 2.5 hours, and then that same community being found not guilty by a jury and being forced to drop all of the remaining charges, is a real low point for the establishment in terms of water charges. It encapsulates this idea that, you know, that these people who don't normally speak, don't normally express themselves, kind of are meant to just know their place and not be active politically, that has changed and that they've become active. And it's a scary thing for the establishment. And so I think some of them took the opportunity of the events around Little, which, you know, obviously are to be condemned, but to kind of link that back to the Jobstown trial, try and demonise the Jobstown community again and say, ah, we told you so, kind of working class people, Jobstown people, they're thugs, and this is proof, which is, it's complete nonsense, obviously.
I might have surmised or guessed that this hasn't taken a toll on you, but obviously you've grown, or you have dealt with quite a lot in a short period of time on, you know, one TD's shoulders.
Yeah, I mean, any one person's shoulders, so also for the other defendants who weren't in the same limelight that I was, which has pluses and negatives, you know, but have kids and families and, you know, people who, if they had gone to prison, which was a real prospect, or certainly it was a real possibility, if convicted, would have been devastating for them. I mean, I found going through the trial is a very strange experience. It went on for a long time. There was 9 weeks of the trial itself, and there was a week when the thing wasn't sitting. So it was on for 2.5 months, much longer than they originally expected. And it was strange because they're not long days in court, really, compared to the kind of days that, you know, I normally work, or most people work, you know. It starts at 10:30 and finishes at 4:00. But it was striking because at the end of every day, I'd be absolutely exhausted, as would the other defendants. And it's just that kind of quite high level of continual stress of having to sit there, concentrate, know that the jury, who hold your fate in their hands, are watching you, you're under scrutiny of the media then as well. It was a very stressful experience. And it was only fully afterwards, when the trial was over, that stress was fully relieved. And, you know what I mean, I kind of collapsed into the summer because of just the level of exhaustion.
And because of that charge, it was a long custodial sentence was most likely on the cards if you were found guilty of that.
I mean, so the potential sentence for false imprisonment is up to life imprisonment. It would have been up to the judge to decide what sentence we got, from a fine to life imprisonment. But I think certainly the prospect of 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years imprisonment was a real prospect. I mean, you know, if you actually kidnapped the Taoiseach, it's not unreasonable that you would go to prison for such a thing, you know? So you can see the logic for that if you're actually found guilty of kidnapping the Taoiseach. So I think that did, I mean, that really hung over people as a very serious prospect. I mean, I remember when the jury did not take long to decide. They were sent out one day, and then the judge changed her directions under kind of pressure from, there was a discussion in the court. So she kind of changed her directions, then they went out again, and they came back very quickly. And you know, all the indications from our lawyers was that was a good thing. They would be very unlikely to come back quickly with a unanimous guilty verdict, given everything that had been seen, everything exposed in terms of what the guards had said. But still, you go back upstairs and you're standing in the dock waiting for the verdict and you don't know for sure. And then obviously it's like a flood of relief whenever they come out with not guilty, not guilty, not guilty.
There was 27 brought through the courts. Is there a camaraderie level of support that you give to each other, and does the community have that kind of support as well in terms of dealing with, you know, what it faced?
Yeah, I mean, it was really powerful, I think, what we built. There was a campaign called Jobstown Not Guilty, which had loads of different defendants from different political backgrounds. So ourselves, four members of Solidarity, a member of Airigi, other people non-politically affiliated but community activists, water charges activists, people who had never been on protest before. And it's obviously a very strong bond that ties people together to face such a thing. And, you know, we discussed our general approach, our legal strategy, our campaigning strategy, together and stuck together, and that was very powerful. And there was, you know, very strong support from the community. I mean, every single day the court was packed, mostly from people who came in from Jobstown, the kind of a rota of different people coming in to watch and to support. And that really kept morale up at a time when, I mean, the trial would just like drag on and on and on. It was difficult for people, or even in some ways it was more difficult for the people who were in the second group of defendants. They had to watch this, knowing that they potentially would be next in like 4 or 5 months time. But yeah, I mean, the community was very, very strong together, and it brought people together. I mean, the water charges brought people together in loads of different communities, but then this was like that plus. It was that magnified by the fact because we were under such an attack by the state.
And this is a qualified success?
Oh yeah, so it's a qualified success by the guards. I mean, it's quite incredible. They have this report. If you remember, after the not guilty verdicts, we launched a campaign for a public independent inquiry. Even Leo Varadkar at a certain time on an RTE TV programme gave the basis of that some credibility by admitting that if there's a contradiction between all the guards' evidence and the video evidence, there might be a problem. And then he called for the guards to look into it, which we knew was obviously a disaster, getting the guards to look into their own potential crimes of perjury in this. So then the Garda report comes out. It describes their operation as a qualified success. The only kind of problems that identifies is that they should have predicted this protest. And they say it's a good thing now that Operation Mizzen is up and running. Operation Mizzen is the spying operation against anti-water charges activists, including reportedly in the media, me, monitoring social media, monitoring movements, etc. So they pointed this is like a positive change that now exists. There is no mention in the Garda report of kind of what's euphemistically called the quality of the evidence, i.e. the fact that the evidence was completely exposed, and not just exposed individually for the guards, but the fact that they were colluding in the same wrong evidence. They were coordinated with each other, but it wasn't coordinated with the reality of what happened. So, I mean, it's really a joke. What's meant to happen is that there is meant to be an appendix to this report, which is meant to deal with the question of the quality of the evidence. We'll see whether that ever comes to light, and I'd be extremely surprised if it, you know, seriously grapples with the problems with the evidence that was demonstrated in the trial.
Finally, then, the spirit of the community where this happened, and maybe more broadly across the country, having had a battle about the water charges and having had a rare success in such a campaign, is the spirit emboldened, or is it, you know, on to the next campaign, you know, nothing to see here, move along, or is there an emboldened victory?
I mean, I think when we look back, you know, say in 20, 30 years' time, and we look back at what I think we'll see, the rise of the left, a rise of like working class consciousness in this country, I think the water charges will be seen as a crucial turning point. Coming from a period of austerity, of crisis, of attacks on people that largely were implemented successfully, i.e. against ordinary people, without massive fight back. You'd protest at the start of the crisis, the trade union leaders just used them to get back into talks, and that was kind of the end of it. And a mood of demoralisation and disempowerment of people. The water charges transformed that. It gave people a sense of their own power, the fact that they have the power to defeat the government on a significant policy. And I think it fed into the marriage equality referendum, which in turn fed into the elections. It fed into some of the important industrial worker disputes we've seen over the past while. Like, it's not an accident that, you know, if you go into Lewis picket line, a lot of the workers there would have been involved in the water charges. If you go on a Bus Éireann picket line, same kind of thing. Like, it's quite striking, is that it's given people confidence. And I think it's also brought communities together. I mean, I remember being on a water meter protest in Whitechurch, and you had like a younger generation of like women in their early 20s and an older generation of community activists in their late 40s, 50s, kind of coming together for the first time. And out of that came more activity around the community centre, things like that. There are ebbs and flows in that. It's not just a straight line in the direction of increased confidence, increased power. I think we're on a bit of an ebb right now rather than a flow. Things have gone out a bit in the absence of the water charges movement. But I think fundamentally it shook the establishment very strongly, and it gave people a glimpse of, we did that once, we can definitely do it again, and it makes it more likely that there'll be significant fight back on the other key issues, mobilizations around repeal and abortion rights and around the housing crisis.
On that note, I think I'll thank Paul Murphy, and the best of luck at your career in the future.
Thank you, Brian.
103.2 Dublin City FM, in conversation with Paul Murphy, TD. If you want to get in touch, email mentalwealth@dublincityfm.ie. We're back next Tuesday at 12:30. Have a great week. Take care. Bye-bye.